a little perhaps unavoidable hot drama this week that we cover. We're going to talk about Facebook and fake news and kind of tech workers' responsibility for the algorithms that we put out into the world. We're also going to do a new segment called The Comment Bag, where we go back, in this case, about cover the last 10 episodes or so and some of the great comments that some of you have left on the episode pages here on ShopTalkShow.com. I should mention that this episode is sponsored wholly by Adobe Typekit Marketplace, which is a kind of a new thing that Typekit is doing. We're going to explain to you how that works in a little bit here in the show. It's pretty cool. Basically, you pay a one-off fee and you own these fonts forever, but still get to take advantage of all that Typekit is. We're going to talk about how the in-app browsers on some mobile operating systems are a little bit different than the browsers, the native browsers, you know, which is pretty weird, pretty confusing, pretty troublesome sometimes. We're going to talk a little bit about FileZilla and some dangers there. Oh, so many questions we're going to cover. Talk about workflows and focus and lots of stuff. And we have a really cool job opportunity at the Array School that we'll mention at the end of the show. Mr. Dave, please kick things off.
Hey there, shopping maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast about websites. I like websites, Chris.
Yeah. So, you know, as we truck along here, entering the lovely holiday season, we're going to continue doing some of these rapid fire episodes. Although we have a couple of shows in development. So look forward to those next year.
We are in pre-production on a hot new season of the Shop Talk Show.
Yeah. Don't get too excited, but they do sound pretty interesting. If I sound awful, it's because I'm in a kind of echoey room. I have done the Wisconsin thing and moved away from Wisconsin for the winter. So I'm down in Miami and I'm kind of in a barren room recording this. So hopefully it sounds okay. Hopefully the sound is okay. But I apologize for that in advance. And let's get into some questions. Actually, Dave, you have an idea.
I wanted to announce a new segment here on the Shop Talk Show called The Comment Bag, which I thought it would be good to go through our comment bag and catch up on some comments because people have been leaving them. So I kind of like dug through like the last five-ish episodes and I wanted to pluck some gems and catch people up on that. Real quick, let's go. I don't know if I did this in order. I'll just go like... Oh, I should have done this in order. Let's go.
You need a better sound for the comment bag. I was like, maybe like, you know, like a bag getting crumpled up. But is that too negative? I don't know.
No, I thought, yeah, that's maybe fine. I thought I was like, are you eating Doritos?
Like, imagine somebody just eating Doritos, listening to comments. Anyway, what do you got? What's a recent all right. comment?
Okay, so let's go all the way back to episode 233. We're getting like 10 episodes back now. I disagree with you on Webpack. I have cheated my way around that tool for quite a while, I was scared off by the sheer complexity of the configuration. Couldn't avoid it any longer. Building a big React app almost demands you use Webpack. I agree. I found a great tutorial and got into it pretty quickly. Well, quickly would be an exaggeration. It took me merely a day to get it working, and more importantly, to get a hang of the many deeper concepts. What I love about Webpack is the consistency it provides. Gulp and grunt combined with Browserify always kind of irked me in terms of, you know, oh, can I get this pre-compiler to work and watch easily? It doesn't seem so meh. Webpack just takes a global watch flag and does exactly what you'd expect. Here we go. It was the first time I perceived a monolithic approach as really, really powerful. Long story short, if you've got to use it, Webpack is an amazing tool. If you want to get into Webpack with zero knowledge, I recommend this comprehensive guide by Juho Vespalinen. I nailed it, which helped me a whole lot. And it's like at Survive.js. We'll put a link. That's from Florian. Thanks. We probably aren't the best people to talk about Webpack, but yeah, it is like a set it and go. right?
Well, I think the configuration for it can be quite tricky. So, I mean, that's the impression that I get from most people is that, like, you know, I'll get like a tweet like, spent the afternoon configuring Webpack. And they're like a little bit frustrated about it, but like optimistic because I think once you get it, it's pretty sweet. And it doesn't have to be hard, but sometimes customizability is hard. I don't know. I have lots of like mini thoughts about it. So I am using it for some projects and generally like it. I tweeted not long ago that it Webpack kind of has the feeling to me of a very, you know, capital letters, title case, very big idea in web development land. And I suspect it's going to be around a long time. That same kind of feeling I put in the tweet of like WordPress, jQuery, React, these big kind of things. I think Webpack is kind of here to stay for a while. I think it's one of those kind of big ideas. I could be very wrong about that. So I publicly said it. So I'm just going to stick to it.
Well, I was going to say, last night, actually, I saw some tweets. Multi Ubel from Cramforce on Twitter is at it again. Inventor of AMP has his own packer. It's called Splittable. A Webpack competitor called Splittable. And I think it's kind of splits by default. It does, you know, as opposed, like, getting Webpack to split, everyone's like, oh, you just use Webpack and you split it and it's fast. And it's like, well, it's kind of like harder to do that. This is sort of, I guess, Google's take on doing a splittable by default.
So, okay. So they'll be competitive. There already is competitors. It just happens to be one that, is pretty big right now. So who knows what will actually happen. I did see there's a number of good resources on it. One that was just going around. There's a Intro to Webpack article that is getting lots of love on Medium by Kimberly Cook called Intro to Webpack. We'll link that up as well as the one in the comments from 233. I listened to a fairly short video on YouTube from Glenn Mattern that explained Webpack as well, that helped solidify how it works at its basic level, that I thought was very good. There's a lot to say about Webpack. Again, we're probably not the two best people in the world to do it, but it does feel important to learn. It seems like it's doing a lot of good things for people and stuff. The hot module reloading is pretty sweet. The browser refreshing is pretty sweet. But there's a lot more to it than that. Apparently at the Chrome Dev Summit, there was a ton of talk about this idea of code splitting, which that's the idea behind this other library too, is that I think code splitting is like a advanced-ish feature or something you at least need to tell Webpack about and how to do it and what you expect from it or whatever. Maybe this new library kind of does it automatically. I think of like tools like Broccoli that came along to compete with stuff like Gulp and Grunt that was like, Gulp and Grunt are great, but here we can see what people are doing with it. They use these common tasks all the time. So this is like those tools, but those common tasks are built in already. It's like an evolution of those tools. Maybe Splittable is like an evolution of Webpack, where like splitting is such a good idea. Let's just bake it in. It has that same kind of feel to me. I did tweet, I was making fun of code splitting just the other night because it feels so funny, right? Like the point of code splitting is let's not send 100% of all of our resources for this website, like CSS and JavaScript, on the first page of a web app. Let's just only load additional little bits of those resources as we navigate around the site and need it, which is a very duh, you know, it's like a very old concept of web development. It just kind of got lost along the way when we started bundling everything together into single web page apps. So it's like, maybe let's start splitting that and start being a little bit more efficient with what we load. And it's talked about like it's this big brand new concept kind of thing. And it is a big brand new concept in regards to automating it. Mm-hmm. But its basic concept, don't load everything at once, is not new.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like now we need to teach the robot to not just, I don't know, put it in one giant box and ship it. So, yeah, I think that's a problem with automation. When you don't see it happen, you just assume it works and it's great because it just happened, you know? And that's, I think, the smart defaults argument. Speaking of web packing and things like that, we did get some other comments kind of like, you should like, you know, you should know a little bit of computer science if you want to be in this industry, because like, in at least the history of things, because like, this is our jobs. Like, don't expect to like use Bootstrap and, you know, make 90K. It's, I mean, I could maybe disagree with that, but, you know, I think that's a good, you know, like, we do kind of need to be learning about things. There's like, somebody's, Alex Zabrowski is mad at Mail2Links because he doesn't have a default mail client installed, so it just does nothing. So there's something to consider. But Lawrence Francell writes in on episode 234. We're now 234. Hi, Jen says, tinkering with the thought of less than 3 seconds load time over 3G versus the massive JavaScript apps, kind of what we were just talking about. I think most of the frameworks load an app into the HTML on a default index.html from the server. Within that element, div hash my app, that's like ID my app in the DOM, we could load some pre-app content. No more than a tiny background SVG preferably, or an image and some text, a simple lightweight bit of content that is above the fold and passes the Google page load metrics and the minimal CSS, etc. I think what you've described is essentially the app shell, which is you deliver like the shell, right, and then you populate it with content. This might improve time to interactive if we had a simple bit of content and a link and to a contact page or some CTA. And then here's a horrible demo. I appreciate the demo, and it's into a code pen, and we can link it up in the show. And it's kind of, it's a cool call out, but it has like a barn, and then the form like loads in later. It all happens. I will say I understand the thinking, but I went through and I traced the app in Chrome. Okay. This is a scumbag thing I do, and I apologize, but I went through, I traced the app in Chrome. I opened up Web Inspector. I throttled my network.
What does tracing mean when you say it like that?
Well, that means like you do the timeline profile stuff, which we kind of murdered in our last episode. I throttle my connection to 3G. Click on network. I go to timeline. I set my CPU to low end device 5x slowdown. Okay. So like a very small phone. And this is a basic site. Like, this is just a background image, some text, Comic Sans, I believe, which is awesome. And then like a form loads. I traced it. It is, it took 10 seconds to load, to be interactive. So like the page painted pretty quickly at about like 1500 milliseconds, which is kind of ideal. But it took a full 10 seconds to execute, all that JavaScript. So, I don't know. And then there's like a long frame where for like 100 or 1,000 milliseconds, it was just the thread was blocked and it dipped down to like 1 FPS. So, and that was just the React-y stuff. So it had to load a bunch of JavaScript. It had to smush it all down, and then it had to run it, and it maxed out the CPU to where the frame janked. And then it was interactive at about 10 seconds. So, I mean, I think it just, that doesn't work. I don't know. Can I be, is that mean of me to say? I just, like, that's a long time. It's a good strategy, and you did fool the user, but it was not interactive until about 10 seconds. So, but.
So when you're thinking about progressive enhancement stuff like this, you should, like, that's a metric you want to think. Like, is it just a trick, or like, is the thing that's there in a progressive enhancement like way still useful, not just a trick?
Yeah. I mean, like you're like, oh, I fooled people, but it's not interactive on a low end device until 10 seconds. And, you know, maybe it works instantly when I like unthrottle and like load it in my desktop, but like, I don't know that it works for phones. That's all I'm saying. I know, like, that I was in a conversation with Sarah Drasner recently. She was kind of like mad about, hopefully I represent Sarah. Okay.
She's so angry all the time. Just furious.
She's just an angry person. Just a vicious, vicious person. No, she was, just kind of like, you know, I'm kind of tired of like perf shaming. And I've seen this from other JavaScript developers as well. I'm tired of like, just, oh, you know, if you do this, you're a terrible person. You know, you've sinned against God's creation. It's just this, like, you are awful. And I respect that. I actually kind of agree. Like, it does nothing to just be like, you're dumb. You didn't do a good website. That does nothing. But I think it's like, how do we do better is the question, especially like if we're considering low end phones. I think the problem too is like React or whatever becomes like a giant fad, and then everyone's like, oh, we're hiring React developers. And then, but like, if you're conscious about, like, I don't know, like a business need or something, you know, it's like, maybe React is actually not meeting the business needs if you need to be super fast. So, I don't know. And then, oh, well, I went to a meetup this week, heard about React, and they're doing like universal rendering with React and Redux and all this stuff. And I didn't even know you could like Redux on the server side sort of stuff. So, you know, it's possible, but it does look like it's like a gigantic effort to make it all do server side stuff too. So I don't know, Chris, thoughts?
It's going to get better though. I don't know. I mean, yeah. I would like to see a framework take this thing where like, there's not just some way to make it work on the server too, if you know, dig into it and research it and figure it out, that it's presented as the kind of the default way that things work. I think that would be kind of like a pretty cool thing for a library to do.
Well, and Preact is getting a lot of attention now, which is like a React clone. And everyone's like, oh, it's only like, you know, 30K or something, or it's something like trivial, and it's pretty fast. And I'm just, that sounds great, but I'm also just like, what is it missing that it does that? That's never clear to me in the documentation. It's like, oh, it's just faster and better, therefore use it. And it's like, well, how does it get faster? Let's just keep going through the comment bag, Chris. 236, Alex Zarowski again, commenting pro, thank you. He was talking about the digging up old screenshots and stuff, and he found this Wayback Machine downloader on GitHub. So that's kind of cool. I didn't know that existed. 237, lots of comments, mostly about like TypeScript and how we're all wrong. And
we've covered that a couple of times, didn't we?
Yeah, it's continuing that discussion, but there's a good thought from Tetragon in there. The thing about security is that it has to be in the back of everyone's brain, just like safety in a factory, which I really like that analogy. Of course, there's a good amount of work that needs to be on the back end, like you guys said, but there are a couple things a front end developer can do to help. One of the biggest is validation. Are you expecting a number in the field? If so, what happens when you put a cat or a dog in there? What happens if you pass an HTML tag like testing heading, and like if you just throw a, I don't know, HTML into the input, what is the intentional data? It may help to think about it as forcing your users to conform to the format you want the data to be in. For example, if you have a date picker instead of a date text field on mobile, is the same way. I personally get irritated when I click on a field that only accepts a number, and their app gives me the full keyboard. So, like if it, I don't know, if you enter a date and you can't type May 15 or something. Also, keep in mind how the internet works. That's nice. If you're building a classic website, the application needs to send a request to the server in order to the backend to validate the information that is being passed. Any work that can be done to verify the data on the front end will save server requests and the number of page loads to the end user.
That's another thing that's just kind of a progressive enhancement kind of thing. That it's always both fun and can be frustrating to work with forms in that way. And then it's like, I'm a front end developer. That's me. I'm going to make this form awesome on the front end. And I'm going to do all this validation and UX work and accessibility work and stuff. But then it's like, your work isn't done here. You know, you still need to be like, okay, now I'm going to pair up with our back end or do the back end yourself. But it's kind of like you got to do all that same work again and be like, I need to validate this data on the back end as well and take even more into account, like security and stuff. And then should anything fail, send it back to the front end and have the front end be able to process kind of what went wrong on the server side too. It's like a big job to make forms really good.
Yeah, well, and you do, like, saving that round trip, you know, like, especially on a phone, that makes a huge difference. I mean, how many, you know, like, if your user, like, has two errors, they're going to give up. But if you caught it before they hit submit, they would probably be, like, a little more likely to complete the
form. I guess that's the bummer part is, like, when you're, like, the front end really is just prevents back end, you know, it's just like a nicety something instead of it being this kind of vital component. They're both vital, but yeah, sometimes I feel like, oh, I did all this work, but the back end still has to do all that same work, but that's the job. And that's why, and this isn't a sponsorship thing, but I tend to like things like Woofoo and stuff when I can use them, because it's kind of like, you get all that stuff for free. You know, they do all the front end stuff and all the back end stuff and all the UX and taking advantage of new stuff and saving the data properly and worrying about security and all that stuff. It's like, I don't know. I like it.
Yeah, no, it's kind of nice. It's just like, I've thought about, like, maybe I should make like a little post contact form just for my website or something, you know, just something I can post data to and I'll get an email or something. And then when I start doing that, I'm just like, oh God, spam. I don't want to do that at all. Like, that sounds terrible. So it's very easy to like talk myself into Woofoo basically. There was a Greg Trevelic writes in, great mention of Todd Motto's public APIs on GitHub that we talked about that. I took a look and found this FOAAS.com, truly an as a service with a difference. Visit that at your own risk.
That's an NSF work, not in a
in
just kind of a language kind of way, if you can imagine that.
Yeah, but not imagery, just languages. FO has a very specific meaning. On episode 240, we were talking about kind of Jekyll static sites and CMSs and stuff. And somebody mentioned, they might have been Cloud Cannon employees, but people mentioned cloudcannon.com, which I took a look at. And it looks, I don't know how it does it, but it does kind of offer a hyper editable front end for.
I have looked at it too, and it does appeal to me too, because you get all the good with Jekyll, with having a CMS as well. And the good with Jekyll is many, right? It's like this clean kind of developer-y cool way to make a website and literally no database, just flat files only on the front end, which means speed, 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 and security. Which is great, and then also you get this, the CMS as well. So,
if that works, I'm very interested. Works. So, if it works, great. I'm gonna check it out. Episode 241, pretty recently, we forgot to link to the 3JS inspector. It's on the Chrome Web Store. If you want to. Check it out. And then Christian Serrano wanted to throw in some CMS talk. I've learned through enough experience that every CMS sucks. That said, I've fallen in love with Kraft. Pleasant experience from the moment I logged out into its control panel. And so I would say, yeah, I've got a couple Kraft things happening right now. And it's just nice.
You really?
It's relaxing. Yeah, it just... we always kind of say, like, what's the tool for the job? And this is one that's like,
the same Kraft has that like user love that so many apps out there want. Is that like anybody who uses Kraft is like kind of a super fan of it, a kind of de facto evangelist for it?
Yeah. So I think it's a good, like, if you haven't checked it out, check it out. I did actually recently, somebody was asking me about it, and I was like, you know, I did I followed a Hello World somewhere and I couldn't find it. So, like if you know of a good Hello World for craft, like just, you know, like the blog in 10 minutes kind of thing, tweet us.
Doesn't Majingo have one? I feel like
Majingo. Yeah.
Those are video courses by Mr. Ryan.
Ryan Ireland. He top quality content, great content, quality content being shipped from Majingo there. Free advertisement. Chris, I think that ends the comment bag. So we're going to close the comment bag. We'll open it up in a few weeks.
Let's do a question and then we'll jump into some other stuff. We have another segment we're going to do this time, a one-off segment. Mike Wags writes in with an interesting one that we talked about a little bit. Dave, when you're, sitting around, plunking away on Twitter, you follow a link on Twitter, the native, like the official app, right? Or Facebook or any native app in which that you like, there's content flowing by, and you click a URL, and rather than being like changing apps, and maybe this is iOS specific. I actually don't know how it works on Android or Windows Phone, but imagine iOS just for a moment. You click on it, and instead of opening the native app, like actually switching apps, it just like slides up a view that is the web, but you never left that app at all. And then you look at the link in it, it can be a little weird because sometimes there's some like extra UI that allows you to like go back and stuff that kind of covers up a little bit more of the screen than you think. But like, isn't that just like Safari or whatever, iOS Safari or what? So Max writes in, I've noticed that the in-app browsers for Twitter and Facebook often display websites differently than other mobile browsers. This is a pretty major issue from my perspective because it's practically impossible to test a site in these in-app browsers before deployment. Have you noticed this issue?
Yes, this is an issue. It's interesting. Like Twitter has maybe like the worst version of the browser. You'd think like, there's Safari on, so it's just going to use Safari. Like it's going to wrap Safari. That's not actually true. In iOS, there's actually three different web views, basically three different web page fetchers in there. And I think Twitter specifically on iOS is using the old one. So a lot of your traffic is actually going through like one of the like older versions of the Safari web view. And how this works is it can be very minor, like just visual, but it can also be drastic. Like the rendering engine and the JavaScript engine could be totally different. It's kind of like, I don't know if you remember that like add to home screen fiasco, where if you have a web app and then it's working in the browser and you add to home screen and it doesn't work, they actually use a different JavaScript engine, like Nitro or something. Or they used to.
That is so weird. I can't even imagine why that's the case. I mean, I know that it is the case, but and then I also seem to remember from not so long ago that wasn't some of this cleaned up at least. I mean, maybe I don't remember or you don't, but it seems to me at some point there was some news that's like, oh, good news, everybody. The UI web view is more like real Safari. It uses the same JavaScript engine now. Clap, clap, clap.
Yeah, so there's actually like three happening. So there's the first one was UI WebView. I think that's like the oldest version of it. And then they announced WK WebView. So WebKit WebView, which is I think supposed to be way more modern, like the current version of WebKit that's on the phone. And then they started offering Safari View Controller, which is another one. I don't know if it's any different than the WebKit, but it may have like a built-in little address bar. I think that may be the like big difference there. The question asker, Mike, was like, have you ever experienced this? Yes, it is a thing. I was going to say, I found an app a long time ago and I installed it and I deleted it, but I reinstalled it for this show. It's called, what is it called? Is it just called WebView? It's called WebView. It's on the app. Duh. It's on the App Store. It has a little HTML5 logo on it, so you know it's web. You can actually load your site in each of the different web views and things. And like, there's a difference, Chris.
Part of the question was that it's hard to test without going to production, but you can't install this. I mean, can this look at your localhost? I guess it could.
Maybe you might have to like tunnel to your local host or something. And I don't know how you would possibly like debug this and inspect it, but you could, I don't know, maybe drive and try to isolate problems or something, or, you know,
at least you can look at it. But that's interesting.
Yeah.
It looks like this is fairly popular-ish. I mean, it's got good reviews.
Yeah. I mean, I think you need something, you know, it's just kind of one of those like, oh man, I need to figure out why it's breaking. And so it's kind of a heavy debugging tool. So that's why I deleted it.
I don't know that it was cleaned up. I mentioned that, but I don't know. Maybe that happened. Maybe it didn't. If you know more, feel free to leave a comment on the thing. It sounds like it is still an issue of some kind. It may be an entirely different JavaScript engine in those things, at least on iOS, which is really weird, but true. Yeah, hopefully that gets cleaned up over time.
There's somebody who did a is it iPhone hacks or something, you know, or like one of these like Mac blogs, right? One of these Mac blogs. They do like a what's new in Safari, like mobile Safari, every like iOS release. So there's only been 10. It's a pretty good job to kind of showing you what's new and what like APIs happened and what's different. So it would be a little bit of a history jog to figure that out, but you could do it. So
this episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you entirely by Typekit, Adobe Typekit, the Typekit you already know and love. I know I do, but this is a brand new thing by Typekit. It's called Typekit Marketplace, and I'm going to explain it in just a second. But like, what do you get normally with Typekit? What's the Typekit that already exists today that you're probably familiar with? It's like part of Creative Cloud, right? So you have an active paid Creative Cloud subscription, and Typekit is the web font service that comes with that. So it's, you want to use amazing, the best web fonts there are, you sign up for Typekit and you have a plan and you add fonts to a kit, and then you can use those fonts on your website. And Typekit makes sure that that happens fast and that they're following all the latest best practices possible and stuff. Typekit is amazing at this. It's the best way to use web fonts on your website. And Typekit Marketplace is a brand new addition to that. So instead of having to have a paid Creative Cloud subscription, you can have a free Adobe Creative Cloud subscription. And then when you're browsing the marketplace for fonts, of which there are 2,000 more typefaces available on Typekit Marketplace than there were before. So this is like a huge expansion of the library that was already there before. You pay a one-off cost. So you're browsing through the marketplace and you see one you like, you can buy it and pay it like a one-off cost, like you're buying a desktop font. And by the way, all these fonts are available for use on the web and in your desktop application. You pay this one-off cost, and then you just have it forever. It's still delivered through the Typekit system, which is good for you and for me and for everybody visiting your website, because it means it's going to take advantage of all that best practices stuff, all that like best knowledge in the industry delivery stuff. You don't have to pay monthly for it. And the reason that's, you know, that can be really good for you because you paid for it. Now you have it forever. Maybe you just like that model. It's good for a lot of the foundries out there creating these fonts. That's why a ton of more of them have signed up to be on Marketplace than were there before. They get a significant cut of these costs. So this is like a way to support good type foundries, is buying through the Marketplace.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, maybe you just prefer it that way anyway. It's not something you have to pay for the rest of your life. You just buy it. You own it. You got it. Yeah. And this is a free Adobe Creative Cloud account that you can manage it with. So, I mean, I have it running right here. It's in my menu bar. I can go under assets in there and look at fonts, and it's showing me all my Typekit fonts and whether they're synced from Typekit or not. This is cool because it's useful for syncing the font for my local use on my computer. I can make keynote presentations or work in Pages, work in any desktop app, and use these fonts from Typekit as well. And this includes stuff from Typekit Marketplace. I think that's super great. You know, I'm making a new, you know, keynote presentation, and I'm just like, what font do I want? Oh, I forgot. I have access to a massive library of amazing fonts to use for this. Now, even more humongous thanks to Typekit Marketplace. So, like I said, there's tons of stuff on Marketplace that weren't there before. Big notable foundries like Farrar Jones and the Type Network is involved. I was just poking around looking at so many super beautiful fonts on here. And it's cool to know that these are just available now and weren't available before. I'm looking at this really cool scribbly one called Shameless by Positype. It's on there. $69.99 it costs, and I'll have it for the rest of my life and can use it on the web and wherever I else want in the world. So the URL there is, if you want to check this out, typekit.com/marketplace. Oh, fonts. So good. Okay, so you have some, we might as well get into some more heavy stuff because we wrote it down. It seems to be pretty relevant right now, especially in the unavoidable light of the previous election. And there was some news right about what they're calling fake news on Facebook and Facebook's, you know, responsibility, or, you know, like, what is it about Facebook's algorithm that shows that stuff? And, you know, Zuckerberg's comments like, yeah, that's, you know, we don't like it, but it certainly didn't have anything to do with the outcome of the election. And I don't know, there's plenty of drama there. This is marked as a hot drama segment. So what are you thinking about, Dave?
I've gotten into a few Twitter discussions. I posted some things on my blog about it, but it's wild that I've seen posts in like fake news is shared at like an order of magnitude more than something the same ish or than a real story.
That's true. And then it came to light when I saw some screenshots of somebody that was like going to post something that had some keyword, you know, some election related something, and they were typing, and then like something popped in below it that's like, you might also want to share. And then it had some like real obviously fake news garbage below it. And the numbers are like, you know, 19,000 people talking about this, and it had some crazy clickbaity garbage headline and garbage graphics and stuff. And that's what we're talking about, fake news. There's stuff that's just like auto-generated and populated and just not true garbage that somehow people like funnel into.
Well, like a bunch of bots will like follow that, you know, upvote it and like make it even more prominent.
That's the algorithm part. They're trying to trick the algorithm into letting it be those suggested articles, and it's working.
That's what's interesting. I think dig.com used to have this problem kind of too. Like this dig brigade would like game the system and like every article would be about, you know, Paul, who is that? Paul Ryan? No, not Paul Ryan. Rand Paul. Wait, no, not him. Who is the guy who ran Relovution or what? Oh, anyway, it was like all like the it's just kind of like makes really minor like small news really big seeming, and it's interesting. It becomes a problem when people figure out how to game the algorithm. And there's an app from the Blue. It's called what's it called? It's called Blue App Red App, I think, or something. And it's from the Wall Street Journal. And it's basically they take two feeds side by side, and you click like a keyword like Obama, and it's like President Obama is the best guy ever, and on the liberal side, and then it's like Obama murdered you know, his cleaning lady on the other side, you know, and it's just like, whoa, like these are like so different. Like, and it's in some ways, Facebook's algorithm has nudged people down these like really conservative and liberal, like kind of like nudging people down these like radical views. And it's really,
do you think it's like, if you, it encourages that if you already believe it, there's no way you're going to change your mind now because you're just going to be validated at every letter you type.
Oh yeah. I mean, and this happens on Twitter too. I think, you know, if you follow Donald Trump, it would recommend you follow David Duke, like the leader of the KKK. Like that's the algorithm. The algorithm is deciding, oh, if you like this guy, you probably like this guy. And it's just, and then like all of a sudden somebody's like, well, he's a, like a congressman or something. Like, so he must be, you know, he must be official. Like, but it's like, doesn't, you know, it doesn't like, it's just a weird, like, if you like this, you also like this sort of, you know, you might also like sort of algorithm. And it just kind of produces, it just highlights these things that are kind of maybe bad, you know?
And so the conversation is like, what is the responsibility of any social algorithm to?
Yeah.
And those aren't like answered questions, right? It's kind of an open question.
Yeah. I think it's an open question. I think it's something we need to be conscious of, like, as, you know, as developers, you know, we do actually kind of, we are a link in the chain, so we can say things. You know, what are you doing to protect your users or do good by your users? But I also see how Facebook is like, well, we're doing good by our users because they stay on our website longer when they read more crazy stuff, you know? And so, I don't know, Chris, it's tough. I think it also means, like, as users, if we understand we're being like algorithmically fed more and more stuff, like, we have to just kind of also understand, like, some of the stuff I read probably isn't right or is not true. It's just been fed to me, you know. That's scary too, right? You're being fed information by a robot. You're not being fed information by a human, a trusted friend, an editor of a like a human editor.
I think about this stuff way too much too. I think if you go down the rabbit hole too far, you're like, I'm basically not even a person.
Whoa!
Like, it's not even, I mean, kind of to some degree, like the reason I am the way I am is so much a product of where I was born and who raised me and where I went to school and all this stuff. And I think that so much of what I think is just me being this free thinking, rational person who comes up with all these ideas on my own, but all the evidence is there that I don't.
Maybe you're an automaton.
And it's not just Facebook. It's like, I don't know. It's just what my parents thought. It's the fact that I grew up in Wisconsin, and I, you know, just there's all these things that, and that's in some degree that, like, when it's something good, we don't, it's no big deal. Like, I love cheese.
Great. Yeah,
well, good. You grew up in cheese country. I like the Green Bay Packers because I grew up in Wisconsin, right? But then if it's something that's like more political or religious or something, it's like worse.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, it starts getting more heavy, you know, and
it feels scary instead of fun, but it's culture too. Mm-hmm.
Well, and from your point of view, everybody would like cheese. What could you possibly have against cheese? The cheese is great, but if you come from a culture where, like, a vegan culture or something like that, you might be like, no, why would you eat cheese? You know, that's wild. That's really, oh no, cows don't like that. They don't want you to do that. They don't want to be eternally pregnant. It's weird. Yeah, I don't know, Chris. I think there is, like, responsibility. I think, like, we have to consider it. But I don't know if it's like a developer problem. I don't know if it's like a, oh, developers, let's solve this. You know, I think it's almost like an organizational problem. Like, what's your organization doing? You know, I'm trying to think of like,
right. I guess that's maybe what's mad is when your Uber boss says, nah, this ain't no big deal.
Yeah.
You're like, what if you think it is a big deal?
Right. Well, and this kind of gets down to, what's a designing for empathy? No. What is, Sarah Wachter-Betcher and Eric Myers' book, just kind of like this
for real life.
Yeah, designing for real life. It's kind of getting to that. Like I do day trip, you know, kind of in as a side project. I want to like build in a recommendation engine, kind of like, oh, if you went here, you'd probably like to go here. But there's things I have to like, you know, kind of keep in consideration. Like we have a lot of barbecue places. I don't want to recommend a bunch of barbecue places. If they're a vegetarian, they'll probably be like, oh, this app sucks. They only just give me meat places, you know, like I don't even know how I'd know their dietary preferences other than asking them. So it's kind of this, I don't know. It's sort of like, we want to nudge people to go outside and leave their house, but what are, you know, I don't know. Are we nudging them to change their belief system about meat? I don't know, Chris, what are we doing? Algorithm. Anyway, I feel like this needs to be a topic of conversation, like at a big conference or South by Southwest or something. Cause I don't know. It's a little ridiculous. So
it's the digital version of a conversation that already exists, I guess was my point. You know, it's like now that these are on our screens or whatever. Great. But it's probably similar to, what should we, you know, what are our responsibilities as a community center?
Yeah, well, and so like Facebook cop-out, I'm going to put Mark Zuckerberg on blast here. Like he's like, oh, we didn't do anything, you know, we don't do anything at all. But like their own research shows that they can influence the election. Like they have research, like multiple research papers that, or if you remember that time where they like showed people happy feeds and people were happier and they showed people depressing feeds and they were more depressed. Facebook can affect people. And like, they know that, but they're also like, oh, we didn't do anything. We couldn't possibly have affected the election. It's like, no, your own research tells you, you can, and you probably did. So it's such a different, it's such a weird world. And, so I don't know, you got to maybe take like these big silos with a grain of salt because they're trying to just make money off of your eyeballs. So
there's like a party in my neighborhood for the election results night, mm-hmm. you know? And there was like a local, just like a little local website that was like, had a post about it. Like, come on down. We're going to have taco trucks on every corner, which is just like a fun little gimmick kind of thing that they did. And there's multiple bars involved. And it was just like kind of a local party. And it was the local rag was a very, it's like a left-ish rag, you know, or whatever. And so the implication, it wasn't clear though. It just felt weird to be in public, like come to an election results party, but like there was one lonely comment at the end of it that was just like, are Trump supporters welcome? And that's it. That's all the thing said. And nobody responded to it. It was just a lonely comment sitting there. And it just felt weird, you know. I don't know. I feel like that's related to this conversation somehow. Like this public event in which it wasn't implied, it was a biased event, although just because of this newspaper and its leanings, it probably was kind of a event that had a feeling one way or the other. And then to not state that, and I don't know how I feel about
technology alienating us from our fellow man. Boom, you burnt.
Okay. Lots to think about there. It feels like it's still an overbearing topic right now. Not overbearing, but it's just shadows everything, right? We can't even get away from it on this technology show. I'm sure people are like, move the hell on. That's what we're going to do. We have one from Austin Turner, although I have thoughts about even that as well. You know, everybody that I've read lots of compelling arguments that say, you know, all y'all white people out there just saying, just move on. Everything's going to be okay. That's your privilege showing. And I get that too. So here I am saying like, let's just move on. Let's talk about something else. Mm. You know, I don't mean to just say that none of this stuff matters. I'm just saying on this show, we're going to move on to the next question.
Maybe we could get a little banjo solo in here. All right. Next question comes from Austin Turner. I've been using FileZilla for FTP for years, and yesterday I read a Slashdot story that people who use it are having their passwords stolen, and that there was a new version out called FileZilla Secure. Can you tell me the difference between them and which one I should use? I have not heard about FileZilla Secure.
No, I haven't heard of it either, although I'm aware of FileZilla. Wasn't it one of the like recommended FTP thing? It's the one that always comes up because it's
free. Yeah, it's like, right? A free FTP solution is what it's called.
I feel like it's in that category. Whenever you mention software, it's like it behooves you to mention the popular one and then the free one, you know? So I feel compelled to do it usually. Like when I talk about Adobe Illustrator, I'm aware that not everybody in the world can have that or wants it because it's not particularly cheap, even though I think it's kind of the dominant thing in creating vector artwork. It's always nice to be like, or Inkscape or this browser version that's free or whatever, because I think that's more inclusive to be like, not everybody has this, yeah. Or particularly when it's like Mac only or something too, it has that same vibe. So I think FileZilla gets mentioned in the, like, you know, have FTP software like Transmit or File.
Yeah. Or it's like a CyberDuck or something. You have like your local stuff and the FTP you're uploading to, like, it gives you two little windows with folders and trees. Right. And you connect.
So unfortunately, I don't know the news here, but was it the fact that if you don't use the secure version of FileZilla, you can lose your...
Well, I think it comes down to a FTP versus SFTP situation. So, and maybe you have to pay for secure FileZilla. I'm not really sure. But so when you FTP into a server, this is just like FTPing into a website, or sorry, accessing a website. There's FTP and SFTP. And if you just use FTP, that stuff is all plain text. You submitted your password over plain text. You can actually...
But that's not FileZilla's fault. I can do that on any FTP.
Yeah, you can do that on any FTP client. But if you want to lock that down, you use SFTP, which establishes a like secure connection before doing
it. Right, it's like using HTTPS, but probably even more important when it comes to FTP. I think it sounds like the deal is that FileZilla can save the passwords to your website, and if you save it and you're using regular FTP, it's saving your password in just plain text on your local computer, and that makes your local computer more of a target for someone could steal your computer, and now they not only have your computer, but they have all your FTP passwords too, which is kind of bad.
Yeah.
Because it's saving them in plain text on your thing. So apparently, maybe this FileZilla Secure on your local computer doesn't save your passwords in plain text. I think of this, it comes up somewhat regularly because I'm like, oh, I got to log into like an old site that I just have hanging around. Everybody's got them, right? And a lot of that stuff I use Coda for on my Mac. I just, and it's like, okay, so this old site, I've probably moved it three times or something since I've used it. Probably the information in Coda is ancient. Or maybe I moved the site and it's just a new server, but all the other information could be correct or something. Like, I want Coda to cough up my password for me because I just need it for some reason. And it won't. It won't. Coda doesn't even know it, or it's like, it's whatever, it won't cough it up. It's not stored in plain text anywhere. I can't get at it, but apparently in FileZilla you could.
Okay, yeah, so you could get it to cough up. That's not good. You know, it's interesting, if I'm looking at the changelog on FileZilla, it's like active development. It looks like it's been like software from the year like 2002, but it had commits yesterday or today even. So I think that just goes to show, like, A, use updated software, but B, I think we kind of all need to be a little more conscious about security. I think we were kind of talking about that earlier. Like, it just needs to be a state of mind for everybody. Security, security, security. So don't put, I even worry about these password managers. You know, it's like, I put it in the cloud and it's got a password, you know, one, I locked my one password, blah, blah, blah. But then it's like, well, now I put all my passwords somewhere and somebody just needs to get one password to open up my one my whole, you know, all my passwords, you know, it's just like, oh gosh, you know, and then I've looked and I've seen like, you know, there's a bunch of other things I'm just like, oh man, what do I need to use to get to have my life secure? But I guess it's a constant battle.
I'm looking at these the version history of it. One of them says fixed a crash on exotic servers, implementing some weird technology or whatever. I like the word exotic in that sentence. I feel like it's used by developers when they mean like a real, real edge case.
Yeah. You know?
It's like almost like a kind of a slightly condescending word, but using like a cool word.
It's like servers just in the Bahamas or something. Just like, I don't know, maybe like, maybe some, place where you'd keep special bitcoins or something. Here we go. Luke Whitehouse writes in.
Last one.
Not my father. Let's see. Hey, guys. I wrote over on my blog about keeping maintainability within your projects, especially for the future when looking into a new technology such as CSS specification, JS frameworks, and similar. Anyhow, the blog post is over.
Oh, it's funny. He linked a .dev domain. He must write on localhost and then push.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because .dev is not a TLD.
Oh, well, thank goodness. It's over on his blog. We'll find a link. Thought it'd be a great discussion for listeners. Here we go. My question.
Yeah, maintainability. And speaking of Sarah Dresner, she wrote a post about maintainability recently too that was quite good, I thought. So here's Luke's question.
Here we go. Luke says, my question is on project maintainability focus. How do you draw the line when researching new technology, tools, and features in web development? Are there any points where, for example, you think, okay, I should stop looking into CSS grid spec and focus on my deadlines? And do you have any scheduled times where you allow yourself to look into these tools rather than allowing your mind to wander wherever? Chris, this is a good question. I mean, like I think we're always on the just build websites train of thought, you know, but like, when do you need to stop just building websites and do your job? So we never talk about that. So,
yeah, I mean, I like the first part of it the most. Like, when do you draw the line when researching new technology, tools, features in development? Does the line mean like I need to stop because I'm like addicted to technology newsletters? Yeah. Or is the line like, this stuff is too new school and I just need to use what I already know and rock and roll? I guess that's the same question, really. But
this is a thing I have in my talk right now, but I'm going to implement my solvable chunks philosophy here. I am a big fan of like a 4-hour chunk. So spend 4 hours on it, play around with CSS grid, try to make something, try to do something. If you like answered your question, awesome, you're done. But you probably have like a few more questions from that 4 hours of playing around. Take another 4 hours. Okay. Try to squeeze it in maybe the next day or that night or that afternoon. And now you have another 4-hour chunk. Check it out. See how far you're getting. Like, how do you feel about it? And by like 2 4-hour chunks, you should have a pretty great idea of what kind of problems this new technology solves. Like, let's just use CSS grid because it's a great example. It's like something you can't super use right now, but you can kind of start getting into. I think like that's good. And then if you like are like all in on something, then just talk to people and say like, I think we need to be using this. I played around with it for, you know, I kind of like got my feet wet. I think I kind of understand the core concepts, but we should do this. So, that's my thought. Take 4-hour chunks until you feel good.
That feels like pretty good advice. You know, I feel weird commenting about it 'cause I'm not particularly sure how good I am at it either. And I'm in a unique position where when I screw around with new tech or whatever, it's like it kind of is my job. So I don't feel particularly guilty about it,
right? You know? Well, and that's I think that's it too. Like, if you like, I mean, you have to do deadlines, like you have to meet them, but like if you're a developer, you know, like learning grid spec could actually be your job. Like that, like you may be able to produce better websites faster, and that has a company that has a dollar amount for your company. So don't not call it work, but you know, you also need to focus on your deadlines. I have a little folder on my desktop called Hello Worlds that I've started. And it's just little things I'm playing with, like building out little apps and, you know, hello worlding little technologies, NPM modules and stuff like that. I like it. I'm kind of just like trying to see what's going on. I think I said it earlier, but I've never really seen Redux like on the server side before. So I'm like, I started following a tutorial and it started and I was just like, okay, let's see what's going on. And it immediately launches into like Mocha Chai, you know, tests, you know, like unit tests and stuff like that. And I just was like, okay, let's do it. I'm just going to do it. Cause I don't do a lot of like unit testing or functional testing. So I just was like, I'm just going to do this test-driven development exercise. And it's maybe a little bit of a waste of time, but like, I'm going to be a better developer at the end of it. So it's not a waste exactly. It's just, but you know, should a deadline like get, like, do I feel the looming pressure of that? I do need to switch over to that. But right now I don't have a looming deadline. I just like a lot of the projects I'm on are in design phase right now. So I have a little bit of time to whatever. Like explore.
I would actually be legit interested in how other people think about that question. So I think there's people that struggle. In fact, we've heard from people before on the show that say like they kind of are like almost addicted to like learning new stuff to the detriment of their productivity. And there's definitely people on the other side who just are just productive all the time and find it difficult keeping up with stuff because they're too busy doing other stuff. And there's a likely a balance between those things.
Don't you run a social network dedicated to messing around with stuff? You probably to
wasting time.
No,
that's only productive all the time.
I use CodePen for work quite a bit, but CodePen's a great place. I mean, talk about the value. Let's sell CodePen real quick. The value of CodePen is you just hop in, you mess around like you didn't have to set up anything on your localhost. You didn't have to fire up a thing. You didn't have to NPM install it. You're just like, boom, just jamming on the browser, seeing things show up. It's great. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm.
In a related sense, it reminds me a little bit of, do you see Dan Mollis falling in your footsteps and
doing Dan Goes Windows.
Yeah. And he has a lot of interesting things to say about it too. He's almost chronicling it on more of like a day by day basis than you did, you know, like kind of a, this is how I'm feeling today about it thing, which is an interesting take on it.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. Like, I think when you change, like start something new or try something new, you really,
How do you feel all this time later about your productivity on do you like
Windows?
Is there ever a day where you're like, I just don't feel like I was as productive today still because of Windows, or I'm more or less or the same?
I think I'm like just as productive. I think that wore off, you know, right about the time they introduced like Linux, you know, it just like things started working, like around build. It just things got better. And I can do just about everything I need to. I don't really experience any setbacks or anything like that. So I'm still enjoying Windows. My supercomputer will hopefully be built soon. So I'll probably post on that.
Interested to see how that goes. I just thought of it because I for various reasons, but I also just got this email from Apple that's like introducing our new book about Apple. It comes in two sizes randomly. The expensive one is $300 and it's just some pages of some pictures of Apple stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just can't. It seems like a parody, but it's not.
Yeah, that's
I mean, I have no against a book that has some pictures of it. It's kind of like an art book, and it's cool to be proud of. $300? What's with the two sizes? And I just, what is happening?
I don't understand. I mean, I guess I do. I understand it. But it seems like big pants when you start, like, talking about yourself. Humble bragging? Is that it? Is that the thing? So anyway, hopefully that
Of all the people in my life right now, there's a lot of them that are just like, I just can't right now. I need to get off this Apple train. It's never been at a higher fever pitch than it is right now. And then this book comes along and I just was like, I'm starting to understand it more and more as a lifelong. I was like a baby when I was like, I've only ever lived in Apple Land and it used to bring me so much joy. You know, and I've like never been apologetic about being a fanboy because I'm just like, I love it. I'm productive here. I like it. And it's just, I'm starting to get it more and more. People are like, bye.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how has Dave Goes Window disrupted your life? No.
Like a 2.5.
Good.
You know, whatever. Like, you haven't convinced me because I have so many other factors working against it, but it's starting to go up. I'm like at a 3.5.
Oh, right, good now. Good. That's what we like to hear over at Dave Rupert LLC, brought to you by Microsoft Incorporated. So we really, really enjoy that. It's interesting. I think there's been just a shift. There's a shift happening. Something's going on. You know, I don't even understand it myself. So, yeah,
I did order a new MacBook. It should come next week and it better be the best laptop in the world.
I've heard it's good. Well, I've heard mixed reviews. Like, I heard haters, but I've also heard people who are just like, this is actually just good. It's just good. So anyway, I'm going to have a supercomputer.
We better go.
We should go. Thanks everybody for listening. Download this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to star heart favorite it up. That's how people find out about the show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show for tens of tweets a month. And you can tweet at us. You can tweet about us. That's how people find out about the show. We really appreciate that. Then, if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and
hey, I got a really cool job to tell you about. It's in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's Wyoming's first private technology and design school. It's called Array School of Technology and Design. They are looking for you to be the professor of full stack web development. So do you have a desire down there in your gut somewhere to teach people, or do you already know that you love teaching people web stuff? They're looking for you to be the professor. You should be competent with kind of full stack stuff though. So it's a Mac only development shop. They teach HTML and CSS and CSS preprocessors like SAS. You should know strong JavaScript fundamentals, responsive design. You should know at least one major JavaScript framework, Angular, React, Ember, that kind of thing. Ruby on Rails and SQL or a NoSQL database. And version control, they use Git. So the stuff that, you know, the big names, the stuff we talk about a ton on Shop Talk Show. Do you want to go teach those things? Be a full stack professor at Array in Cheyenne, Wyoming. You do, of course. The details for applying are in their very good job posting, which we'll link to from the show notes here. And of course, it's on the Shop Talk Show job board as well.
I think that's going to do it. Chris, do you got anything else for us?
ShopTalkShow.com.